Hey everyone, welcome back to the Commercial Real Estate Library Podcast. This is episode 54, and today our special guest is Cedric Bobo. He is the CEO and co-founder of Project Destined, a social impact vehicle that trains urban youth and military veterans to become owners and stakeholders in the communities in which they live, work, and play. You might be thinking to yourself, where do I recognize this name from, Cedric Bobo? Well, it might be from his many appearances on CNBC. It might be because he was formerly a principal at the Carlyle Group. You might know his business partner, Alexander Rodriguez of the New York Yankees. You might know some of the companies that Project Destined partners with, Blackstone, Brookfield, the Lakers. I could go on and on. This was one of the more fun podcasts that we've done. Absolutely love Cedric, and he's got an incredible mission. But he's also a real estate owner, a real estate executive. So if you are interested in becoming a real estate owner, this is the podcast for you. Before we dive in, I want to quickly do a self-promotion for myself and Garrett. Garrett is a managing director at Gemreal. He helps find you capital. He's a mortgage broker that specializes in Canada and the US. They do a lot of residential land lending, a lot of construction financing. If you have questions about that, please reach out to him. He's done $2 billion in placements and debt placements over his tenure. His phone number is 613-816-6563. Yeah, 613 number. I know what you're thinking. And myself, I lead the Ontario multifamily team out of Colliers. We sell a new apartment building every few weeks. In the last 30 days, we just sold 33 units in Orangeville, 260 a door, record pricing. We just sold 44 units in Midtown, also record pricing. Just sold 118 units in downtown Toronto, which closes in a week. And hopefully this podcast doesn't jinx it. If you are considering selling some real estate, especially on the multifamily side, reach out to us. We'd love to give you an updated valuation, something that you can rely on. We specialize in maximizing value, especially for private ownership groups, and we'd love to work with you. If you're a broker, that goes double for you. We'd love to collaborate. You can give me a call on my cell at 647-915-3193. Again, 647-915-3193. I hope we didn't lose 90% of the audience. This podcast is amazing. You're going to enjoy it. Thanks so much for listening. Take care. Everybody, welcome back to the Commercial Real Estate Library Podcast. I'm your host, Damon Tamanawala. You know my co-host, Garrett McGilvery. And joining us today is the CEO and founder of Project Destined, Cedric Bobo. Cedric, thanks for joining us.
No, thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure and grateful for your partnership.
Appreciate it. Okay, so real quick and just at a high level, for those who don't know, can you share a little bit about Project Destined before we dive into kind of your background and your whole story?
Yeah, I mean, look, our platform is very simple. We train folks how to become owners. I think if you go into real estate today and people tell you they want to teach you, you have no idea if it's selling houses on Saturday or whether it's building tall buildings. And so we take an ownership approach to training you how to be an owner in your community.
Right. And just a tiny bit more on Project Destined. So you're training high school students, college students, and
keep going. No, I mean, look. I mean, I'll walk you through the full story. We have high school students, or depending if you're in the UK, pre-college students. We've got undergraduates. We have adult programs for military veterans. A program with moms who want to explore real estate. We build programs for, you know, sports teams. I mean, we will build anything you want. We just love to teach people how to become owners through real estate. That's really kind of our fundamental purpose.
Cool. Okay. So for our audience listening along, we're going to get back to the present day. But first, I want to rewind. I want to go through the story of how you became a principal at Carlyle, how you partnered with Alexander Rodriguez. Let's rewind all the way back to, you grew up in Memphis. Were you interested in real estate at an early age, or how did you kind of get that kernel of an idea?
Look, the thing that has really been present throughout my life is that I just always wanted to be an owner. I had a great grandfather who bought 100 acres of land in 1890, built a series of agricultural businesses, and my kids still play on that land today. And there wasn't a day when I didn't think about, like, how does a guy do that in 1890? So I wanted to be an owner like him, frankly, because I saw the way my grandmother spoke about it with such pride and never thinking of him as a victim. And I think that just always stuck with me. And so I studied engineering in school, you know, really because I thought that would get me a job. And then I did a summer program at Harvard Business School. And that was really when the light bulb turned on about, like, there is business education and there is a global field to play on. I followed that, by spending a year abroad at Oxford. So I went to the UK. I studied politics, philosophy, and economics, but I played rugby with folks that were doing investment banking. The way they described it, it felt like it was a more profitable approach to the same math that I was doing. I went to Wall Street for a summer and to a place called Salomon Brothers. They happened to put me, look, I didn't know what the hell investment banking was. I just knew it sounded great. My mom was impressed modestly. I got there and they put me in the private equity coverage group. I had no idea what private equity was.
What year are we talking about, Cedric?
Yeah, so 1997, I show up, in New York for a summer internship prior to my senior year of college. And I'm at Salomon Brothers. I don't know what they do. I have never read Liar's Poker. I'm put in the private equity coverage group. I had no idea what that was. Imagine I'm going in. I don't know what investment banking really is. I don't know what private equity really is. And then I quickly learned that these folks use other people's money to buy stuff. And I told my mom, I cannot believe that's a job. Like, that is fascinating. Actually, if you get paid to use your money, I was like, and I get a piece of the profit. I told my mom, I don't know what we were doing before. And so I decided I was going to spend 20 years doing that if they would have me. And so I went to do 2 years at an investment bank called DLJ, only because they were known for getting you a job in private equity. And I took a job in private equity on the West Coast, sort of doing middle market buyouts in Silicon Valley. I wasn't doing tech buyouts, but I was in Silicon Valley. And I think that entrepreneurial mindset really kind of stuck with me. And then I came back to Harvard Business School, and my wife is, you know, Nigerian, Russian, Jewish from London. And so I moved to London after HBS. I mean, candidly, I moved there because I felt like I worked so much. If my wife was closer to her family, I could stay out of trouble because I worked so many hours. That was my logic. That did not prove to be true because she liked me too much. But what happened is her father was a very confident Nigerian surgeon who also bought real estate in South London. And I was just in shock. And I tell the story to everyone because I was shocked you could do this. I was like, how do you actually do surgery all day, but yet you own these apartment buildings? And he was like, look, I just go out and get a loan and I buy a unit and I rent it out to somebody. And I was like, that is fast. I said, that's what I do with companies. And so I was still working in corporate buyouts then. And her father just was always buying these units. And I was like, Natasha, we should start doing this. So we started buying little crappy units in South London, which is where we could afford. So if you know London, like Norbury, Sydenham. And then I took a job at the Carlyle Group doing corporate buyouts again. Carlyle was an aggressive acquirer in markets across the globe. And I think what happened to me there is, as I matriculated sort of through the firm, was I was like, wow, they buy a company in China, company in Japan. I was looking at a deal in Istanbul, and it's the same culture all over the place and the same kind of approach to buying stuff. And so I kept buying apartments in different parts of the U.S., still in London. And, you know, when Carlyle went public, you know, I was like, well, now my wife and I have enough resources where we could begin building something of our own. And that was when I really transitioned into doing real estate. I was like, well, you know, why don't we build something that allows us to invest in real estate? And then simultaneously, I wanted to build an apprenticeship program. That was really the transition.
Man, that's I told you this before, but it's so much life experience packed into, like, I mean, that's just incredible. Makes me want to travel hearing your story, actually.
Can I tell you something? The thing that happened to me is that when I stepped off of, you know, Virgin Atlantic in London in 1996, when I was studying abroad, there was something about walking around a city in anonymity. Like, no one knows me there. They don't know if I'm, you know, Ethiopian, Nigerian, of mixed British heritage, right? And there was something powerful about the ability to create my own story. And I think for me, what that translated into is like, well, I just got to go and find places where I can run hard, where maybe they don't know me that well to put me in a box. And if I keep running hard, you know, maybe I outwork my opportunities and more come my way because they don't know how to put me in a box. So London and UK really opened my eyes to where, you know, look, I am a brown dude from Mississippi. Like, that is where I am. I'm extraordinarily proud of it. But I don't really allow people to put me in that box when they're shaping opportunities for me. And I think that was transformative. Similarly, when I got to San Francisco, and I got to San Francisco in 2000, right before the dot-com bubble kind of burst. And I was really like walking around. I was like, look at all these people not afraid to fail. In fact, failure wasn't a scarlet letter. It was like, you got a badge that you were at a failed startup and on your second one. I was like, man, like, you all have redefined failure as experience capital to help you get to your next deal. And I was like, man, like, that's fascinating. You could actually color the picture that way. And so for me, traveling around kind of helped me step out of my comfort zone and not really fear failure.
So interesting. And by the way, Garrett, so we've started to do a lot of these online, so it's harder to read Garrett when he's going to cut in or not, but.
For sure. They're definitely a lot easier in person, mainly because of latency issues and all that stuff. But in terms of, obviously, you started Project Destin, you sort of, you know, went through your career, you sort of jumped into the end in terms of you becoming a real estate owner, and you started an internship program, Project Destin, to sort of train people. What was your motivation behind starting that element of your entrepreneurial journey?
Yeah. So I'll tell you something that I think is pretty funny, right? So when I left HBS and I moved to London, you know, I told my wife, I was like, well, I want to live in Notting Hill. There's that fancy Hugh Grant movie about Notting Hill. I was like, that sounds like a fancy place to tell my mom I lived. And I was, she was like, I made it. I'd done well. And my wife was like, she was like, in my family, we don't rent other people's homes. And I was like, oh my God, well, I can't buy in Notting Hill. And my wife was like, well, I don't think we should live in Notting Hill. We gotta go find somewhere to buy. And this was an identity crisis of sorts for me. So I told my wife, I was like, hold on. I just moved to London. I was like, who's going to loan me money? Like, who's going to give me a shot to buy a building, you know, a building or even apartment unit? I was like, why would someone loan me money? And my wife, and she can turn on a Nigerian accent when she's disappointed. She was like, man, Tim, going to Harvard Business School, you don't have a lot of confidence, do you? And she's like, have you even called a bank? I was like, no. She's like, well, why don't you call a bank? Isn't that what you do for a living? And so I called a bank, and I got on the phone with this banker, and I was like, look, my wife told me to call you because she wants to buy this flat in London. I just need you to just check the box and say, like, I've done it. I was like, so like, I'm trying to buy this flat. It's £250,000. You know, I want to know if you give me a loan. Just thinking the guy in, like, some fancy British accent would say no politely. And he was like, well, do you have a job? I was like, yeah, I have a job. He's like, well, do they pay you money at that job? I was like, pay me money. He's like, do you have a contract where they say they will pay you money? I was like, yeah. He's like, well, can you get me that contract? And he's like, we can loan you 70% of the cost of that property. I said, well, hold on. That's fantastic. I said, but I don't have the other 30%. So, like, how do we figure out? So I said, what about you loan me 99%? And I'll get you that letter. They'll show you that they actually will pay me for the next 2 years. And he came back. I got a 99% loan, interest only, for 25 years. I still own that flat. It's probably worth $1 million today. I have paid, I think, less than £1,000 a month for that property for, like, the last, you know, 20 years, right? And so that taught me something, is that, like, man, like, sometimes if you want something, why don't you let your goals overwhelm your fears and just ask people? So the rest of my life, I just started asking folks for what I wanted. So fast forward to Project Destin. So after Carlisle, and I wanted to build this platform, the logic was this. You know, I've been buying companies in Europe and Asia with Carlisle. I'd also been buying, like, little apartment units, crappy ones completely. And I was like, I told my wife, I was like, look, you know, you and I, my wife's a mechanical engineer too. I was like, we chose engineering because of high school aged programs that told us we could have a good life through STEM. I said, and that's true, you can. I said, but why isn't anyone teaching folks they could have a good life by owning buildings in their own neighborhood? Like, you don't even have to leave your neighborhood to actually feel well. I was like, why isn't someone teaching kids that? Because every kid doesn't want to go study engineering or anything else. And so my wife and I were like, why don't we create this apprenticeship program? And then we were at the BET Awards in 2016. And we had a friend, Deborah Lee, who ran BET at the time. And they were showing a movie about Detroit. And I was blown away by how much capital was going into Detroit, a very diverse city. But there weren't a lot of diverse owners in Detroit. And I was just kind of shocked at, like, look at this narrative. The city had been through bankruptcy. It was coming out. There was all this money that was flowing in, But yet the diverse folks weren't participating. And so I flew to Detroit a few days later, and I was like, well, to the mayor's office, I was like, what if I brought my own money to invest? Would you introduce me to a few schools where I could try and pilot this apprenticeship program? And so I met with a few schools. We recruited 15 students. And we had this program where we would actually pay them a stipend. I believe in monetizing students' time. I have an anti-charity mentality, but a pro-talent mentality. And so I was like, well, I'll pay you all a stipend. You all will do training in real estate, right? But simultaneously, you're going to take that training, and I'm going to give you live deals in Detroit to analyze. And then you're going to work in like five-person teams, and you're going to pitch me. And so my wife and I bought two of those buildings. We still own them today. I got a bunch of press because we're helping us buy buildings. And then we went to my hometown, Memphis, to do it with a big REIT with 25 students, bought another 8-unit building that they pitched us. And then I randomly took my wife and this TV executive, Deborah Lee, to a J-Lo concert. If I'm very candid, I thought Jennifer dated Drake. So I thought it was going to be Drake backstage. It turns out A-Rod opens the door. And then someone Googles me because they can't figure out why the hell I'm back there. And so they see Carlisle, they see Project Destin. And I didn't know that A-Rod started buying apartments when he was like 21 years old, a duplex in Miami. But he now owned 15,000 units at the time. And Alex was like, why don't we do Project Destin, you know, in Miami? And I was like, it's 1 a.m. in Vegas. I was like, well, he's probably not very serious about that. But it sounds nice, and I can tell all my friends that A-Rod wants to party with me. And so he calls me 3 weeks later. And we have a 4-hour dinner, and I'm big on picking dates. So we picked a date to launch. We launched a few months later in Miami with the Boys and Girls Club. We learned to play baseball. And, you know, Alex was like, you know, train these students to have the same background as me. And so we took 40 students, largely English as a second language students. So we built this e-learning course they could take before we started, just help them get to have some comfort with the language of real estate. And then we trained them up. They pitched us deals. I bought a building in Northwest Miami near related development. And then I invested in a building with A-Rod, private equity firm. At the end of it, Alex was like, why wouldn't we do this all over the world? And he brought in Judy and Jamie Dimon and John Gray from Blackstone. They were our first financial partners. And look, they were backing Alex's friend. They didn't know me. But they brought in our first college group of students. And we had never done college only before, or primarily college. And we took those students through our program, and I just saw it. I was like, hold on, these kids can get a job out of this. And so we've gone from those 15 students in New York at our college age, we've now trained over 1,000 students at that college in New York. You know, we now train 500 college students every semester, 100 high school students every semester. And we built this platform, and it's all because of the real estate industry is like, wow, you train them up, and then we get a chance to look at them, but they now speak our language. That was the evolution of it.
How long have you been doing this for? Like Project Destin?
When did we ran our first course in September of 2016 in Detroit.
Okay. Yeah. Do you have any like highlight success stories of like an individual that's gone through the program and, you know, perhaps more now works at Blackstone or Carlisle?
I'll give you big picture data points, and I'll give you some specific war stories. So we built a program for the Real Estate Board of New York, which represents all the largest, you know, landlords in New York, from your Hines to your Brookfield, you know, you name it, Rental Green Oak. We trained 350 students for them after the pandemic hit because so many kids lost their internship. Of those 350, we can track there's an 11 of them, right? Nearly 84% have gotten jobs or internships since the program at Blackstone, at Graystar, at Brookfield, you name it, JLL, CBRE. All of these are wonderful entry points. What's even more amazing about that is that we didn't pick most of them, right? Some of them were freshmen, some of them were sophomores, but they use this platform to tell a story about themselves. The other piece to it is we have a staff today of 150 folks that work for us. All of them are alumni. We only hire our alums. We don't have a single person that didn't go through our program. So my view is if we don't hire them, why the hell should anybody else? So that to me is a big part of it. The other piece is like I'll give you a student, Miles Franklin from my hometown, Memphis. I met Miles. He's a graduating 12th grader in Memphis. He was late for my first class, by the way. And he went from doing my program in the summer of, I guess that was 2017 when he was, you know, 17 years old. Then he was heading to George Washington for college. And before he even went to GW, he was at Freddie Mac giving a presentation with me about our program. And this guy, David Brickman, who then ran the multifamily part of Freddie Mac, offered him an internship as a freshman. So his freshman year there, he then went to work for a large owner-operator, Cortland, which owns probably 30,000 units. As a sophomore, he was their top intern over the summer out of all interns, not just diverse interns. He then went to Brookfield his junior summer, right? And then he got a chance to come back to Cortland full-time. They created a national position for him as an asset manager. But he still wanted to work for in development. So then Tommy Craig from Hines gave him a chance to spend his summer before coming to Cortland by working in development in New York. And so this is a kid from Memphis, an intern at Freddie Mac, Cortland, Brookfield, Hines, now works full-time. And he didn't go to one of their target schools. He just got a shot, and he outworked his opportunity. Like, so to me, that's an incredible story for a young man.
Yeah,
yeah, it's so impressive. And Cedric, can you talk about locationally? Like, where are you guys based out of? You're in Canada now. You're just launching. That's how we got connected at one of our buildings. Can you talk about where you are geographically? And then if you could dive into a little bit of how the program really works. You know, what are these students learning?
Yeah. So geographically, we first started in Detroit. Then we went on to Memphis, then Miami with Alex, then New York. New York really catapulted us because we built the program for Brookfield in the Bronx. They enjoyed having a big development there in Mott Haven. And they asked us to explore, you know, launching Los Angeles with a guy named, Adrian Foley, who runs development business on the West Coast. And we partnered Brookfield and the Lakers because we do a lot with sports teams. And that was the first time we were in a virtual program. So it's 2019, it's the summer. We launched LA and London simultaneously, and we have to go virtual because they're so far away. That set us up for success. Following in the fall, we ran a virtual program that was across 19 colleges. And then the pandemic hits. And then we accelerate because we have a proven product that's virtual, and the world is moving to virtual. So we went from really kind of 6 markets at the time of the pandemic. Now we're in 20 U.S. markets. We launched London in 2019. We launched Paris last fall with students from a school called ESCP. We're launching Toronto now with Bento Green Oak and hopefully soon Colliers. We're launching Vancouver this summer with Marcus and Millichap. And look, we're going to dominate globally. We're going to be bigger in Europe this summer. We have a global partnership with WeWork. They give us free office space anywhere in the world where we launch. So we'll go into Asia. We have 150 corporate partners, and those folks are the largest owners in the world. So as long as we prove our worth, they will take risks with us in growing. And whenever we grow in a new market, so for example, we're growing in London this summer, I will not even invoice people until the program is done to make sure they're satisfied with it. Because I take all risks to start. It's my dollar. My dollar goes in first because I just work better when I know my reputation and my money is on the line. Right, that's just my sort of framework for doing anything. In terms of the operation of a program, I think what makes it unique is that in every market, students study live deals, right? I think studying a live deal, not a case study, gives you something you can put on your resume because you can talk about it. You can go and see it, touch it, feel it. It becomes tangible. It also introduces us to people in the market. Like, I met you because we're studying one of your deals. I would not have met you had I not had to source opportunity in market for those students. So it makes you part of the local fabric. If I just did a case study, I could do it from my home, Washington, D.C., but never have a reason to really engage in the Toronto market. By it being a live deal, like now I'm looking at it, evaluating it. And so in terms of after we sort of launch in the market, students go through a 10-week program, right? It's broken into 3 rotations. First, you study the market and the project. That's 3 weeks. Second rotation is the valuation and value creation. My fundamental belief is any fool, including me, can buy something and lose money. So you have to study valuation and value creation together. Because what is the valuation? Why does it matter if you don't have a plan for increasing the value? The third rotation is deal financing, understanding equity and debt. My principal point to students is banks make money by loaning money. They just might not be giving it to you. So have a business plan and a set of partners that help you acquire capital. Now, within each of those rotations, the same 4 things happen. The first week I teach you. The reason why I teach you the first week is I have to give you the language, the concepts, but more importantly, what I lacked in London to start, a belief system that you deserve to be successful, that you will be successful. So I teach the beginning of a rotation. That's the first week. The second week of rotation, you get together with mentors and you take those concepts I introduced and you apply them to a building, bringing it to life. The third week is that you're actually presenting like a Shark Tank style panel to a set of judges from all over the world. So it's learn it, apply it with mentors, and pitch it. Now, I hate life thought of as a bad Eminem song. So the idea is that it's not one and done. It's three rotations. Every rotation, learn, apply with mentors, compete, right? And so if it's Team Colliers, if you finish second to Brookfield, you're going to be pissed off. The next rotation, you're going to invest more time with those students. They're going to perform better, and you're going to see their growth, and there's still another rotation. So it's really, it's almost like a playoff series where you're constantly evaluating different pieces of a deal.
Wow. And like you said, I mean, you're in so many different markets now. Do you find that it's kind of the same principles applied no matter where you are? Or is it challenging, you know, breaking into Toronto versus, you know, somewhere in Southeast Asia?
Yeah, right? Well, look, it all starts with people. Like, the biggest challenge for me is just getting to the right people. Like, look, I had to get to you to source that deal. That takes time. People need to go and Google you and talk to their friends and make sure that you're someone that's credible. So that takes time, same in every market. What doesn't change is our philosophy around being competitive, looking at live deals, because I think that's essential. Now, I will tell you, when we launched in Paris, we had a student from Paris who just kept emailing or connecting with all of my staff on LinkedIn saying, please come to Paris. And I was like, well, if someone's that tenacious, they must really believe in themselves. I said, someone just go do a call. If you all want to launch Paris, I'll fund it. But you got to put together a plan with her, right? And so she came back to me in like a wonderful French accent. It was amazing French accent. And she says to me, Cedric, in Paris, we're not competitive like that. And so like, I don't think your competition worked very well. So like, I think you need to change it. I was like, well, okay. You guys may not be competitive who are not winning in Paris, but the rest of the folks who are buying buildings and winning at life, they are competitive. They're not just teaching you to be competitive. Why do they want you to be competitive when they want to actually earn all the money? I said, you need to be competitive so you can actually break down the barriers so you are one of those folks. And so we don't change that element in any case. It always is competition-based because kids have to learn how to articulate their narrative, to be demanding, to be curious, to actually go out and connect with people and be brave. And the only way you can do this is if you practice with us.
Wow. And then Cedric, you mentioned at the end, sometimes there's an opportunity on a live deal for, you know, whoever might be a partner or you or maybe the students or whomever to actually go forward and buy the deal. Like,
yeah.
How often does that happen?
Well, in the early days, every city I launched, I bought something. It was my commitment. I was always going to find something to buy. So for the first three or four markets, I always bought. And the reason why I bought was twofold. One, I mean, I like investing money. And I thought multifamily was a great investment, especially 2016 and 17, and it proved out to be. But the other thing is that I thought it was really important for diverse students to see a brown dude and his wife both doing the teaching and the buying. I thought it instilled a certain confidence, a certain awareness that you're capable of attacking your own problems with confidence. And so I thought it was important that those students not just see me teaching soccer, but also playing soccer at a high level. And I thought that gave us credibility because, look, I'm spending $500,000 on at least on a property in every single city. And I don't live there, right? And so I thought that piece was really essential. Now, today, what's more common is, like, students are evaluating or they're on team BGO or they're on team Brookfield. Not evaluating one of my deals. But I think me looking at my deals kind of gave the playbook for how to do it. So Brooke was like, oh, okay, we're just helping them analyze the deal, whether we buy it or not, no worries. So I would say students actually buying the deal today is less rare, right? Because I'm not sort of the person with the keys. But the realness of it hasn't changed because when you invoke competition, people take that very seriously. And when you're on Team Colliers and Team Brookfield, you're representing their brand and they don't like losing. Right. Yeah. Their brands represent winning to them. So I think that brings a real realness to it.
Interesting. Hey, by the way, I can confirm that at Colliers on our last Ontario sales meeting with, a couple hundred people, they're talking about Project Destin and how to get involved and something that they're thinking about and moving forward and excited about. So
that's great.
So it's great. Yeah.
So, Cedric, you've obviously created a really successful platform. Where do you see yourself taking this in sort of like the next 5 years? Like, obviously, you're geographically, you know, expanding yourself out as well as making more new partnerships in those markets as well. But what about the program itself? Do you have a master plan that you want to get to, or is this it?
Yeah, no, I mean, like, I want global domination. Like, I don't have any modest goals. It's not how I stay motivated. I mean, so look, from a framework perspective, you know, I wake up every day and I tell my students that I wake up every day and I have butterflies, I'm nervous, I'm insecure about what I'm trying to achieve. Not because I'm an insecure person, because I care a lot. Just like an athlete, you get on the field and it's something important to you, so you're nervous. But for me, my goals have always overwhelmed my fears. And so I'm always setting new goals. And so, you know, I want to be globally relevant. I want my students, you know, in New York to understand investing in Dakar, Senegal, right? So for me, like, I want to have a global platform. I want my students to learn about other parts of the world through real estate and then know they have a skill set that's relevant in markets across the globe. And so we've got to have a global presence in leading markets around the world. Luckily, we're fortunate, like, a lot of our partners are present in all these markets. So it's not necessarily incredibly difficult. It's just prioritization. So for me, going to a new market, I always follow my partners. Right. So, for example, if Greystar says we're willing to partner with you in London, we launch London. Right. In that market, we're also doing Invesco and we're talking to other players. So we really follow our partners because the goal is to train students so they can have a shot at buying something and a career. And so we've got to get across the globe quickly because, look, there's a huge focus on inclusion today. There is no guarantee the moment doesn't shift. Right. So we got to take advantage of our moment from a numbers perspective. You know, we train 500 to 600 students every semester today. I would like to be at 1,000 this time next year. And so my wife and I are investing a ton of money in systems. So like today, we use this project management software, Monday.com, to kind of build in tasks. Well, we're investing a ton of money. Every one of our students this semester, every intern, they're using Monday.com, and we're collecting data and organizing tasks through that. The reason why we're doing it is that, one, if we teach them project management software, when they get to Greystar, they're going to be better at actually managing projects. Even in investment banking, look, when I was a banker, I was constantly managing projects that my associate gave me. But I never had a project management tool to keep me organized. It was more like sheets of paper that randomly told me what to do. So building systems and processes is incredibly important. So we're going to invest $250,000 this year and next in just systems. So every single one of our students learns project management, because ultimately what we're doing is teaching that tool. And that's what also gets me to build that into my culture so we can scale over time.
Got it. It's so amazing. And by the way, Garrett is incredibly system-based. So you're speaking his language there.
That's how I live my life.
It's easy to imagine, you know, the Project Destined alumni network just being insanely powerful, global reach, and, you know, they'll pick up, you know, one another's call for sure. Somebody who went through the program 10 years down the line, like, you know, these might be the most powerful people in real estate.
Well, the thing is that I think there has to be a rigor to this. So you get the right people on the bus, right? You can't make such, like, I'm not a big believer in just having kids do a speaker series on real estate because there's no rigor. I like a speaker series in complement to some rigor. So all of those students, when they see each other in 15 years and they start talking, they will start talking about what deal did you have? What corporate? Oh, I was Team Brookfield. Now I work at Greystar. I had this crappy deal that Cedric chose in Brooklyn and I couldn't get any value add because of rent control, right? So, like, they will have war stories the same way the three of us have war stories from being in dynamic industries where sometimes the deal goes well, sometimes it goes crappy, but the stories stick with you for a lifetime.
Wow. Okay. So Cedric, you have tremendous partnerships, and I mean the companies that you're mentioning, Lakers, Brookfield, you know, Colliers, you know, great partners. How do people get involved? You know, if somebody's listening to this podcast, we got a ton of a big real estate audience. Mm-hmm. How can they be part of this?
Well, the thing is that, you know, the power of our work has been through people. The most compelling part about real estate is the people, and the fact you all like each other. It's fantastic. Look, if someone wants to get involved, I'm super active on LinkedIn. And so, like, I love when people just send me a note on LinkedIn saying, hey, what the hell do you actually do? Can we get on a call? I take every single call personally. That's how I was taught at Carlisle. And so connecting with me on LinkedIn, Cedric Bobo on LinkedIn, it's a funny last name, so it's not so many of us. And then just connecting with me, sending me a note on what is it that we do that could resonate with you? Because what I want is people to never sort of engage us because of pity, but more because there's something what we do where they can really tell a story about themselves. And so for me, connecting on LinkedIn is the powerful way to engage.
Wow. Okay. Okay. I still have a bunch of questions, but they're kind of quicker questions.
Cool.
So I guess we're in a very strange time. Inflation, you know, I think I read something from David Rubenstein, just a headline, who's the founder of Carlisle. You know, don't worry about inflation, something, I'm butchering it. But, you know, how are you, as a global operator, how are you thinking about inflation affecting your real estate investments? Or just the low interest rate climate in general?
Look, you know, I started buying multifamily because I like the asset class, whether it's inflationary environment or not. I just like the asset class. I think people need housing. And I think especially class B and C housing is affordable. I think regardless of the environment, I tend to be a contrarian. And when the world says everything's becoming to be a mess, I tend to start buying then. You know, I'm the person who, when Mr. Big on Sex and the City, you know, died on a Peloton and the stock went down, I bought a ton of Peloton stock. Right. Because I just think, like, you know, and life is about finding great companies or great products, great assets, and investing in them. I'm fortunate because it doesn't feed my family, right? So my investing in real estate or in stocks is really, you know, about, you know, building wealth. So my sons have a great life and a head start. And so, like, I buy things I care about. Like, I buy real estate in markets where I think that there is, you know, growth in the market. And over time, I'll be able to build cash flow and cap rates will be favorable. So I really don't focus on that as much because I've never sold an asset, right? I'm going to keep them for a lifetime. I've never, you know, all those assets I bought in London, I still own every single one of them. I never plan on selling them. Really, I just want to teach my sons how to manage them, right? So I don't think about that as much as you would. And part of it is my framing. Like, when I was at Carlisle, it was all about finding good assets and having an edge. My edge today is that, look, if I look at buying real estate in Phoenix, I have 50 students in Phoenix, so I can get to know the market and where students want to live because I think I have insight into what's going on locally. So for me, it's less about what's going on in terms of interest rates or inflation and more about, do I like the market? Does research tell me that there is some growth to that market because of jobs or other things?
Okay. And do you... This is a question I'm thinking about right now with, you know, we're selling apartment buildings. Sometimes, you know, I just sold one for a 2.5% cap.
Yeah.
Great. Right. So, yeah. You know, what are some markets that you are really interested in right now from an investment perspective?
Yeah. So, I still love the Detroit market. I've made a good amount of money in Detroit. I just think that it's a complicated market because, you know, you can buy assets there, but they typically require some kind of significant value add. So you've got to make sure you're not afraid of that. And the market's somewhat volatile because all these neighborhoods are remaking themselves. But I still love the Detroit market. You know, I've done pretty well in the Florida market, both in the asset that I own near Miami because Related's developing there. And then Fort Lauderdale with A-Rod, a deal with A-Rod that's going very well. So I think that, you know, that's nice. I mean, I'm spending more time looking at, you know, everywhere from Nashville to Phoenix. And you know probably why I do it is because when people start saying things are overpriced and that they're a mess, for me, I just go and look for ugly stuff in those markets. Like, people typically like to look at things that are pretty and shiny. I don't mind problems because I don't have this sort of, you know, 3-year time period to go and kind of get them right. I can be more patient. If it takes 10 years, I really couldn't care less. It's more, do I think there's a chance for me to add value? That's the thing I worry about more. Like, at Carlisle, like, I used to get tired of people saying you all overpaid for that asset. And to me, you don't know if you overpaid until, like, you sell it, right?
Right.
So overpay just means I paid the most for it. So of course, yes, I overpaid, which is why they sold it to me, right? But to me, it's more about what do I think I can do with it? What can my relationships and my insight bear out? And if I do that well, I think I'll make decent money.
Wow.
Well, there you go, Damon. Proving a little more of my investment thesis that we were talking about the other day. Say to you, Cedric, I was talking to Damon because I own some properties in Windsor. So I look at Detroit all the time, and I've basically been a lot more bullish on the Detroit market just because of pretty much the reasons that you've been talking about.
Yeah. It's a complicated market, though. I mean, it really is.
It's, yeah, 100%. It's
like construction there, like finding a good, you know, partner on the construction side is really, really difficult. But look, it's a really, like, if you spend time there, it's like, it's just the people in Detroit are incredible. And we actually have built programs for Detroit Public Schools. We partnered with Olympia Development, the Illich family. And so we're in with Quicken Loans. And so, like, I really just love the energy of that city. And it's, look, you have all these sports stadiums downtown. Like, it's just a, I think it's a special place.
Yeah, it's definitely on the up and up from where it was 20, 30 years ago.
Oh, my God, yeah, yeah. I mean, look, it's going to hit some challenges along the way. But to me, as I tell my sons, the challenges are when you buy, right? Mm-hmm. Look, anybody can buy when it's, like, sweet and kind and everybody's like, oh, Detroit's amazing. You know, I like to buy when people are like, well, I'm not sure. It's kind of a mess. And I try and connect the fundamentals as I see them with, do people want to live there, which is fundamentally what it's about. Look, in Detroit, there are lots of companies coming, but the housing is coming very slowly, right? Because it's all development. And it takes so much time to develop the assets. And so as long as companies keep coming, the city will be fine.
I'm going to start looking up where your properties are, if I can find that property management company. So that, yeah, I know these are well researched. Let's see if I can buy near Cedric.
Dame is your neighbor soon.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
I love it.
I one more question. I'm just very curious. What's it like working with A-Rod?
How God changed my life. I mean, I got to be straightforward. Is that when we did the program in Miami, you know, I was building it as something really as a gift to the community. It's like I wanted to teach them how to become owners. I hadn't really thought about it as sort of like a education platform that could really grow into something that became much more like a global training business. I just hadn't thought about it like that because I was too much in the entrepreneur mindset of like, let me just build something that actually adds value, adds meaning. And then Alex was like, why wouldn't we do this everywhere? And I think his framework, like the athlete mentality is a special one because look, they're the product every single day and they got to believe in them, right? And I think his kind of self-belief, whether it's sports or increasingly today business, I think some of that just kind of translates to you. And so we began partnering in a few markets and I was just kind of wow because I think he's a better business person than baseball player. I mean, I think he's an incredible baseball player, obviously. But I think what he's doing in business today is pretty remarkable. And I think that he's an incredible, innovative person who knows how to sell the innovation. Like a lot of folks have the innovation, but they don't know how to attract the capital. And I think he's got that rare ability to be innovative, to make a bet, but also attract capital because of his relationships. And he did that for us. Like no one knew about us to him and Jennifer, you know, kind of backed us in Miami and they came to one of our events. Most folks don't know this, but we launched that program with Judy and Jamie Dimon and John Gray in the March 2018. They actually skipped the Oscars to come to one of our competitions at Yankee Stadium. And my mother-in-law, even in London, heard about it. And I think they really just put a light on what we were doing. And look, when the cool kids are doing something, even if people don't follow, they read about it. And when folks read what we were doing, like, oh, wow, can you teach kids about real estate? Like, that makes some sense. So I think they just put gasoline on a fire and helped us really blow out and grow over time. And for that, I'm incredibly grateful.
Amazing. I guess, like, maybe it'd be good. Actually, Garrett, do you have any last questions?
No, you can go for it.
This is a tough one, but what advice would you give to maybe a high school student or just a young person who wants to be an owner, get that mentality and get on that side of the relationship? What would you say to them?
Well, the first thing I think in having an ownership mentality is that you've got to set a big goal where the goal can overwhelm all your fears. It doesn't have to be the right goal or the perfect goal, but it's got to be some goal because the goal gives you the discipline to make better choices. Like if you're just going to do anything, then everything that comes your way sounds reasonable, right? But you got to have some goal, some framework for making decisions, right? Set that goal and just run towards it and just stop forgetting about all the voices in your head that make you question yourself. So I always say, you know, start with a goal. I would read this book, Atomic Habits, I've only read it lately. Lots of our students are reading it. And the reason why I recommend it is because of something he says in the beginning, which is that to ultimately form great habits, you got to have the right beliefs. You got to believe that you are a certain type of person. And to me, that's about goal setting. I had this belief that I was destined to become an owner. So I started making all my decisions about doing that, right? And I just think for young people, just decide that you are a certain type of person, pick a few goals, chase them like crazy, and everywhere you go, tell someone you want to do that. They laugh, screw them. If they smile, ask them to help you. But set some goal. People want to help people who have clarity of mission.
Yes. I love that. And by the way, another little tidbit, you got to find obviously a great partner, because it sounds like your wife had a little bit of an inspiration as well.
Oh yeah, she's the best. Push, my favorite.
99% mortgage in London.
Oh yeah. Oh my God, yeah. No, I always tell people the time, like my wife runs the show, and we have a house that's three stories tall, and I was at the bottom and she was at the top, and she asked me to do something and I couldn't hear her, so I was yelling. And my son, I have three sons. My son was like, "Dad, I wouldn't do that. It doesn't work for me." I was like, "No, I was just trying to get her attention." He's like, "No, for no reason should you do that. It's not an effective strategy." And I was like, "She's good. She's a smart, the right kind of tough."
Awesome. Okay, Cedric. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it. And
thank y'all.
Yeah, thanks for your time.
You're doing a wonderful thing, you know, getting out there and teaching these people, you know, how to get into the real estate business, because, like, this is a closed-door market for a lot of people. Yeah. So giving these kids these tools, like, you're training the next generation.
Thank you all so much, and thank you for articulating our story. It's incredibly important work, and Damon, I'll see you very soon as we keep pushing forward this semester.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, awesome. Take care, y'all.
Thanks, Cedric.
All right, bye-bye. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.